طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that each week we present it on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Our entire broadcast this morning is our conversation with Boston College professor Eve Spangler, who for the last decade has taught a course on the Israel-Palestine conflict. As part of the course, she takes her students to Israel-Palestine each January. Upon her return just a few weeks ago, she wrote an engaging article for the news service Mondeweiss, and it is the observation she made during this last trip, reflected in this article, that we will discuss this morning. Eve is also an author. Her most recent book is titled Understanding Israel-Palestine: Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict, where she applies human rights standards to the current struggle. A must read. Here is our conversation with Eve Spangler. Eve, you teach a course at Boston College on the Israel-Palestine struggle. I take it it's a sociology course?
Yes, it is.
And I'd like to begin with our discussion of you describing the course. What are you trying to achieve?
Well, I'm trying to get people not to be afraid of thinking about the conflict, because most people's first reaction is, oh, it's too complicated and they've been killing each other for hundreds of years and how am I ever going to contribute anything useful? This is in the context of BC, which is constantly drumming into students that they should be people for others. So we want them, of course, to come out of school and be able to make a living, but we also want them to make a difference and to want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, in that context, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think, often feels to people like just a bridge too far. So I'm trying to demystify that. And I'm making an argument in the course, it's a seminar we meet once a week, in favor of human rights as the basis for addressing this conflict. It gets you out of the endless he said, she said kind of back and forth. So we start the course by looking at human rights documents. Everybody thinks they're in favor of them, but they haven't actually read the Universal Declaration, the Geneva Conventions, the basic texts. And so we start with a conversation about what those texts actually say, what they require of us, and so forth. Then I have a section that's probably the longest on the history, looking at the conflicting narratives. And then I do a section that I think very few people who teach the conflict do, which is I look at the economics of it, of whether or how it profits Israel to be an occupying power. And, of course, their military industry and their military technology makes the occupation very profitable because it becomes a kind of lab for testing new weapons. And then we look at political conflicts, which is the one-state, two-state debate, which is now shifting very rapidly thanks to President Trump's comments. And then the last section of the course, I let students break themselves up into work groups to pursue interests of their own. So one group typically is about pop culture and how the conflict is portrayed in rap music and spoken word poetry and media like that. One group will be, because strangely I attract a lot of pre-med students, so one is on health, one working group. One working group is on religion and religious narratives. I don't think this is primarily a religious conflict at all, but for people, the question there is for people who are not fanatics or fundamentalists, but who take their religion seriously. What does Islam or Christianity or Judaism require of people? And then the last working group typically is comparative conflict resolution. So how have other long, intractable conflicts ended? So students then report back to the class. So those are our units. And then we go on a trip over winter break of about 10 days, half in Israel, half in Palestine.
And talk about the students.
They're wonderful.
Typically take this. Are they sociology majors, or do you draw right across?
It's a very mixed crowd. Some are sociology majors, and they're likely to have taken other courses with me and to know me. A lot of them are international studies majors, or fewer than I would have expected, Islamic civilization majors. And then I have this cluster of pre-meds. And now, you know, I've taught it for 9 years, so now there's a kind of referral network. Almost everybody who comes has a friend who's done this course and trip before.
How many kids are we talking about?
25 or 26 a year.
Wow, that's a
good size.
A good
group.
Size.
And, yeah, it's sometimes a little challenging on the trip.
Particularly when you're moving them overseas, right?
Yeah, moving them overseas, eek. But they're wonderful. They tend to be very good academically. I'm very pleased that I've been found by our Ahana community. That's an acronym. That's sort of communities of color. Mm-hmm. Because I'm very, very interested in promoting the civil rights view of the Palestinian struggle and the ties to the American civil rights movement. So some of that is happening.
So do you get a diverse crowd or diverse
Yes,
students?
It's usually about two-thirds female, one-third male. It's the majors are variable. Generally, it's about half seniors. That's an artifact of how BC registers students. Seniors register first, so they think about it first. But very different juniors, freshmen. So even the occasional freshman who's really together and figures out quickly that this course is available. A variety of majors. BC is predominantly, of course, a Catholic university, but I've had Jewish kids, I've had Muslim kids, mm-hmm. I've had Birthright alums. So I try to diversify largely by major, and I try, there is an interview, there's an application process to pick people who are just nice and will be pleasant and caring of each other on the trip, because we're bearing witness to very difficult things.
Has the, particularly the trip, really impacted the Jewish kids? Because in this country, or the Arab kids that might go, because in this country, we really don't get the coverage, the news, and the facts about what's really going on in Israel. So I imagine when they go over and see it, it probably is quite a
quite a shock. I think it is for all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, there are less than 1% Jewish students at BC, and so although I welcome them mm-hmm. in the class, there just aren't that many of them.
Yeah.
And they are shocked, but I think not necessarily more so than other students. I mean, you go to Hebron and you see streets with concrete dividers down the middle,
right.
You know, and there's a Jewish-only side of the street and an Arab-only side of the street. Well, you've never seen anything like that in America.
Yeah.
You know, you don't meet people who's, well, you do, I guess, in communities of color, but BC students don't typically meet families whose sons have been gunned down by the army or the mm-hmm. police. And so things like that are quite shocking, but I don't think particularly more so to Jewish mm-hmm. students. They've read all the materials in the class, and so they're pretty... There's nothing we see that they haven't read about, although they often don't realize it until afterwards. They think, oh, hey, we read about that, and I'm like, yeah, we did.
Yeah. How is the course viewed on campus in BC? Are you getting any pushback on it? On many campuses across the country, there is pushback. Pushback against professors like you that dare to teach this. Pushback against organizations that are pro-Palestinian. I just wonder what you...
I have had a little bit of pushback, but largely from undergraduate students. There are three professors who don't like what I do. The first time There was no pushback because nobody knew the first time that I was giving the course except my students. And then they came home. And another requirement of the class is that they do something to put their education back into the world. And I say to people, of course, my passion is human rights in this particular conflict, but if they are passionate about some other justice struggle, gay rights or immigrant rights or whatever, that's perfectly fine. That meets the requirements. So the first year we came back, and I did in that year have five Muslim American, Arab American students, and so they wanted to create an Israeli apartheid week, which they did, and a big wall on campus and had speakers come. And then, you know, there were three professors who were terribly unhappy about that and upset. And I'm told by hearsay that they advised their students not to enroll in the class, and then their students enroll anyway. That's how I get told about it.
It ends up being an endorsement for a lot of kids, right?
It does often, of course, have that perverse effect. But the school itself supports the trip financially through a program that supports many study abroad and social service trips. And so I'm in that pot. You know, my chairs, my department has always supported it. So the pushback hasn't been bad. There have been some fairly immature undergraduate responses, but, you know,
which is to be expected.
Almost funny.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I really can't complain. I think the truth is that because we're a Jesuit institution, we have relatively few Jewish students and probably also relatively few now, relatively few Jewish donors. We did at one time because in the social science building, you see, you know, the Abraham Schiffman elevator and the, you know, Fleischman seminar room and so forth. So I think before Brandeis was created, BC got quite a lot of Jewish philanthropic donations. But I suspect now we don't.
Yeah.
So there aren't a lot of external pressures on the school. So I'm lucky. That way I just go ahead and do my work.
Now, when you came back from Israel-Palestine this past January, you wrote a fascinating article in Mondawise, the news service Mondawise. You started the article with this provocative paragraph, and I'm going to set you up for your own words, okay? Having just returned this week from a 17-day human rights trip to Israel and Palestine, my 10th in as many years, I conclude that the best description of the emerging situation is this. A perfect storm is coming. All the most destructive forces are aligning to produce possibly violent change and uncertainty early in the Trump administration. Unquote. Okay, that's a fantastic opening.
Boy, did I
read that and said, oh boy, you know. She's on fire.
Yeah.
Okay, what's? I mean, you obviously had quite an experience. This, and you obviously are concerned about what's happening. So,
yeah, I think yes, I stand by that judgment. The worst forces on all sides are coming to the fore. I don't think, in fact, I would have. Let me inflect that one way. The Palestinian forces are not terrible. They're just terribly weak. So Abbas is simply providing no real leadership that anyone has any confidence in. His electoral term ended in 2006, and he's been governing with executive orders ever since. And there's no sign of reconciliation among Palestinian factions. There's no sign of an election. And so I think the Palestinian voice continues to be very weak, but this is particularly strategically unfortunate at the moment because the Israeli forces are moving more and more toward a preemptive one-state solution that involves annexation of all or part of the West Bank. Gaza is somehow not in that equation, but it will continue to be policed and oppressed.
Right.
And so, you know, the Israeli political scene is moving, I think, quite rapidly toward annexation. Netanyahu, in spite of his now trip to Australia and the United States, is under the same kind of investigation that's led to Olmert's imprisonment. And so he's wounded. and he's trying to keep an alliance entirely with the people to the right of him intact. And so they're being more and more aggressive about demanding annexation. And then Trump, who, you know, in my view, doesn't know what he's doing at all, is opening the door to a one state through annexation without the consent of the Palestinians, and not to become a democratic single state of all its people, but to become an apartheid state with, you know, one set of rules for Israeli Jews and another set of rules, actually multiple sets of rules, another set of rules for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and then a third set of rules for Palestinians who will be, I think, soon annexed to Israel.
But even before Trump's election, it's quite clear that the two-state solution is just not a possibility anymore, and that the Zionist vision has always been take the land from the sea to the river, and they've succeeded in doing that. And one could argue that the Oslo Accords was about really buying time.
Exactly.
And so Oslo Accords are passed. Nothing definitive is decided, really. There's no goal for borders or anything. Buys time. Israel just continues to take the land. And that's always been the goal.
That's always been the... I always want to give people I disagree with the benefit of a doubt. And so maybe, you know, for 5 minutes at the beginning of Oslo, somebody really thought there was a deal to be made there. But very quickly, it turned out to be that the whole peace process is a fraud. It's a cover for building settlements. But now I think we're in the end game, both because geographically, you know, there's just no more place. Everything's been taken. You know, all of Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, which is 22% of historic, or slightly less, of historic Palestine. So we're talking about now 11% that could conceivably be Palestinian. That's not contiguous. It can't be sovereign. It's not economically viable.
And people can't pass freely between any other.
Even different parts of what is left to Palestine. No, so, you know, the one state was always the Zionist intention. And to be fair, the one state was always the Palestinian preference. They never agreed to divide their homeland, and they've never seen any justice in the demand that they should divide their homeland to fix something which is a problem of European Christian anti-Semitism. So, in fact, the so-called universally agreed upon two-state solution, and I always put universally agreed upon in air quotes, you know, was a plan by imperial powers, the same people, the same idiots in Whitehall who drew lines on pieces of paper and created African nations of people who didn't want to be together. And so I've always been an advocate for a single democratic state of all its people, which would have to be multicultural, as every state needs to be in the 21st century. But now I think from the right wing, and with the intention of making it an apartheid state, we're seeing what was always the goal coming to fruition. We're right at that point where it's not going to be a goal, it's going to be what happened very quickly, I think.
I think the hope was that a lot of Palestinians would leave. I mean, their vision is all the land without the Palestinians, which isn't quite working out.
I mean, they have all kinds of sayings: maximum geography, minimum demography. The intent was ethnic cleansing, and they, in the days before political correctness and in the early days of Zionism, talked about this very openly as the transfer. And they tried, even in still colonial times, to get the British to transfer all the Palestinians out of their path. The British declined to do that. And then, you know, it's as though Zionist leaders every single morning get up and say, the ultimate goal is all of the land and none of the Palestinians.
Right.
And given the circumstances today, what is it we can get done toward that today? And there are two, you know, major strategies. One is physical coercion and violence, which is used, I think it's both brutal and horrible and given Israeli military capability, could be far more lethal than it is. I mean, I think the violence is used semi-judiciously to send signals saying we are capable of much worse, be careful. And so, you know, the story I tell, this is from the last trip. We have a bus driver on our trip whom we've worked with for a number of years now, and he's generally a very cheerful person. And he was looking really kind of grim one day, so I had seen the things the students were about to go see, so I sent them off. There are other faculty on the trip, not just me. And I sat with the bus driver and said to him, you know, you're looking kind of grim, what's up? And he said, well, you know, my nephew was 17, he was killed last week. And today we just got the report that the Israeli army is not going to investigate. And then he told me an absolutely horrific story, which I've since repeated, and the Israelis in the audience get very upset. So let me qualify that I'm not saying this is a typical story, but it is a story that is spread far and wide in the Palestinian community, and you can see how it serves as a kind of intimidation. So his nephew was 17. He got his first college acceptance, and he was ecstatic beside himself, jumping up and down and yelling and screaming that he'd been accepted to college. It was late in the afternoon. And suddenly all his friends showed up, and they were all dressed up in their, you know, go-to-wedding suit. And he said to them, how did you know I have this wonderful news? You're all dressed up for me. And they said, no, silly, you've forgotten. There's a wedding in the next village. We're not dressed up for you. We're going to the wedding. Put your wedding suit on and let's get going. So he changed his clothes, and off they went up two-kilometer dirt road to the next village. And as you can imagine, a group of 17-year-old boys with great news, jostling and shouting and making noise. So there's a settlement nearby, and the settlers called the army and said, you know, noisy Palestinian youth were frightened, and the army said, okay. And they declared the road to be a closed military zone, which they do by declaration. They didn't post it. They didn't go to the Arab village where the Palestinian village where the wedding was and say, hey, that's now a closed military road. They just declared it amongst themselves. And so late that night, when these same group of boys was walking home to their village, probably also making some amount of noise, they suddenly found themselves surrounded by Israeli troops, IDF troops. And, you know, why are you here? Why are you, you know, suspiciously well-dressed? What's going on? And so all the boys pulled out their IDs and said, oh, we live in that village over there. We're coming back from a wedding, except the nephew, because he changed hastily. And so his ID was in his jeans at home on his bed. And he was a well-dressed young Palestinian male with no ID in a closed military zone. And so one of the IDF soldiers, a woman, she was like probably 18, she walked around behind him, jammed her rifle butt into the back of his knees. He fell to the ground, and she just leaned down and put her gun to his head and blew his brains out. And so Israelis will tell you that is against Israeli military regulations. That's probably true.
It
wasn't filmed.
Yeah, but we hear that story again and then again.
It wasn't filmed.
Almost weekly.
Yeah.
Frankly. I mean, if for them to deny that this isn't typical, I mean, they need to be reading Horace.
Yeah, exactly. But even if you think it's not typical, it's exceptional, it's now, you know, 20 other boys and all the surrounding villages know this story. And so it's intimidating.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's, you know, one means that's being used is physical brutality and intimidation. The more common is bureaucratic manipulation. And so, you know, you get stories of permits, the whole permit regime. If you want to widen the path from your house to your well, you need a permit. If you need to get chemotherapy in another country because there's no cancer treatment in the West Bank, you need a permit. If you want to go to a cousin's wedding, you need a permit. And those, of course, are used in a very manipulative way.
And all this to make life difficult with the hope that they'll leave. Tell a story in your article, the story of the village that built
the school,
the playground. Because, again, people may say this is not typical, but this is very typical. And it's the kind of oppression Palestinians face every day. But this is an incredible story.
Okay, so this is a story where Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are being bullied. Okay, they are Bedouin citizens of Israel. And they are living in a village called Khan al-Ahmar, which is now under complete demolition order. That has happened since we returned from the trip. And this is a tiny little village. So the Israelis have decided that the semi-nomadic way of life characteristic of the Bedouin is now unacceptable. It's not, from their point of view, good land use. And so they are trying now to contain the Bedouin in designed villages and to not let them be moving around the Negev with herds of sheep and goats. So they're building intentional communities for the Bedouin, which someone who didn't study history is eerily enough calling concentration villages. And this is why everybody should study history. But in any case, these particular Bedouin in Khan al-Ahmar have refused to be relocated. And so they're living in really shacks and tents in a cleft between two mountains, sort of tucked in between two mountains. And that little cul-de-sac they're in is surrounded on all sides by Israeli highways. And there's one little underpass under the highway that connects.
The only way in and out of the village.
In and out of the village. Okay. So they're really trapped in a very small space. And they themselves live extremely modestly in tents. But they want their kids to have a good education. So they built a rather handsome three-room schoolhouse out of tires and mud. They just stack tires and then, kind of caulk them with mud and painted the walls and painted, lots of pretty pictures for the kids. And we went into the school. There are chairs and desks. There are blackboards. There are even a few computers. A lot of English lessons on the board. The kids are all bilingual. So this place is becoming a bit of a politically known place that diplomats go and photos are taken and so forth, because you can see the tires through the mud when you photograph the walls. And so an Italian diplomat came and said, oh, heck, we're going to donate some playground equipment, and he came back with playground equipment. Well, this is the eerie part. The neighboring Israeli village monitors these people with a drone. Now, I did not find out whether the drone was provided to them by the government or they just took it into their own heads to buy the drone. But anyway, they're monitoring this Bedouin encampment with a drone. So they called the police and said, I'm sure they have no building permit and they're putting up a playground. Come quickly. And the police came so quickly and demolished this playground that had been donated, that the Italian diplomat, who was the donor, was still on the site drinking tea with the villagers who were thanking him for the playground when the police rushed in and demolished the playground. And so we saw the remains of the playground when we were there. Since we came back last week, the entire village has been ordered to be demolished, including the school, because obviously this is now becoming an embarrassment to the Israeli state, and a lot of people are going there and photographing it, and the social justice tours are going there. So now they're going to just destroy the whole thing with demolition orders.
This is within the Jerusalem. You said south of Ramallah, and it's
just slightly north of Jerusalem. Yeah, but, 10-minute drive from Jerusalem.
But within
Israel, within 48,
within
the Green Line.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah, and these are Palestinian citizens of Israel. You know, the very first year we visited a guy in Al-Walaja, which is what we would call a neighborhood of Bethlehem. If you get in a car in Al-Walaja, you can be at the Church of the Nativity literally in 3 minutes. So we visited a guy named Mahmoud, who was sitting in his home. We had tea with him in his home, and he had just gotten back from prison because he had been arrested for trespass. So we asked him, well, where were you trespassing? He said, well, by sitting here in this house. And we said, well, but we thought this was your house. And he said, yes, this house was built by my grandfather. My father was born in this house. I was born in this house. My three children were born in this house. But the neighborhood of Al-Walaja has now been rezoned from being a part of Bethlehem to being a part of Jerusalem. Jerusalem and Bethlehem are a distance of, let's say, Newton Center to the Watertown Mall, so very near. And it's as though you suddenly rezoned Watertown Square into Newton. I mean, you know, it would not to Americans make very much difference. But the what happens in Israel is that Palestinians are not allowed to live in Jerusalem without a Jerusalem ID. So when the government rezoned this little neighborhood into Jerusalem, it refused to issue Jerusalem IDs to any of the inhabitants, and so they became trespassers in their own home. And Mahmoud was arrested for trespassing. So we met him the first year. The second year we went back, he was gone, his family was gone, but the house stood. It was under demolition orders. The third year the house was gone. The fourth year the wall had come right up on that property. And the fifth year there was a McMansion coming up over the wall on the Israeli side. So this is another way you get people to leave, through zoning, through house demolition.
That's how you steal land.
That's how you steal land. That's how you steal aquifers.
That's right. That's right. Which is how they take the land. And a lot of people don't really understand that. They just don't understand that the way the land is being taken.
Yes.
Is this way.
Yes, and now, of course, they even, again, since I returned from the trip, I returned January 7th, the Israeli Knesset has legalized retroactively, which I think is completely unprecedented in legal annals, that you can retroactively make things that were illegal at the time they were committed legal. Not just going forward, you can change the rules of the game, but you can change them retroactively. So they've now retroactively ratified that land taken by physical expropriation by settlers, that's legal. So you can, as a illegal Jewish settler in the West Bank, simply begin to build on your Palestinian neighbor's property, and the Israeli state will retroactively ratify that as legal, which is, you know, completely bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if there is the one state, of course there is a one state solution. It's one state now.
Yeah.
Certainly not two states. It shifts the way the occupation proceeds in a way. Right now in the West Bank, it's a military occupation.
Yes.
It differs somewhat from what Palestinians who live in Israel experience.
Yes.
What they experience is what the one state will be. That is, but there are some 50 laws or so that segregate them, that discriminate, whereby they are denied benefits, education,
water,
travel,
schools,
all kinds of things. So this is the face of the one state that would be for the entire historic Palestine.
And at best.
And now the struggle becomes a civil rights struggle, in a sense.
Yes.
It is trying to create a state where all its citizens are equal.
Yes.
Equal benefits, equal rights, etc. And that's the struggle because Israel is a theocracy.
Yeah.
Israel has a set of laws for Jews and a set of laws for everyone else. And that is segregation, no matter how you cut it, no matter what words you use.
Yeah, and I think, the mechanism within what the international community regards as Israel, so Israel inside the Green Line, the mechanism is that they have this very peculiar definition of citizenship that, again, I think is the only country in the world that does this. We use the term national and citizen interchangeably. You're an American national, you're an American citizen. For them, those are two different levels. So you can be a non-Jewish citizen of Israel. 20% indeed of their citizens are of Palestinian ancestry, some Christian, mostly Muslim. So you can be a citizen, and that gives you the right to vote, even to serve in the Knesset, to use the facilities of the National Health Service, to go to public schools. But you have to be a Jewish national and the state here is doing something, again, peculiar in defining Jewishness as a nationality. You have to be a Jewish national in order to be allowed to buy land or in order to be entitled to family unification, so that if you are an Israeli Jew and you meet an American Jew at Boston College and you get married and you want to go back and live in Israel, there'll be no problem. Your American Jewish spouse has the right of return as a Jew and instantly becomes both a citizen and a national. But if you are a Palestinian born in 48 Israel and you meet a Palestinian from Ramallah at Boston College and fall in love and get married, you can't live with that person.
Right.
And the Israeli Supreme Court has two or three times affirmed that the Interior Ministry can impose these rules against family unification. And the language was very interesting of the Supreme Court. They said, you know, we're not obliged in the name of human rights to commit national suicide. And so we do not let Palestinian citizens of Israel bring spouses into the country from other places. So you don't have a right to family unification. So at best, that's the face of the one state. There's really four kind of levels of discrimination. One is sort of direct legal discrimination in which overtly Jewish people are given rights that are denied to others. And the best example of that is the right of return. I'm Jewish. I could go to Israel tomorrow and I would go to the head of the queue for a job. I would get instantaneous citizenship and
property,
and, you know, I'd be...
You get subsidized property.
I'd get subsidized property, right? I could, you know, move to a Palestinian house and expropriate it, right? So there's direct legal discrimination. Then there's indirect legal discrimination, which is laws that appear on their face not to name Jews and others as separate entities that appear to be race-neutral, gender-neutral, and so forth, but which, in fact, benefit Jews. So, for example, ferocious veterans' preference. Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel are forbidden to serve in the army, so only Jews serve in the army, and Druze, a few Druze.
And a number of benefits accrue from serving
in the military,
those benefits are never accessible to anyone. Yeah.
That's right, but the law simply says veterans benefit, right. So it appears neutral on the surface. Then there's administrative latitude, as there is here, so all the executive branches of government, you know, put less money into schools in Palestinian communities, don't build good roads in Palestine. This is Israeli citizens, Palestinian citizens of Israel. Don't get good roads, good schools, good clinics. Everything is understaffed, under-resourced. And then finally, there's a cultural thing that the whole culture of the country affirms the Zionist agenda. So you observe Jewish holidays, you put the symbol of the Jewish religion on the flag. You have a ceremonial calendar that, you know, tells the story of the rescue from the Maccabees, the rescue from Egypt, the, you know, Fallen Soldiers Day, the Holocaust Memorial Day, and then Independence Day. So your whole ceremonial cycle says they're always trying, everybody's always trying to kill the Jews, and only through Israel do we survive. And of course, that's, you know, not the story of
A number of people that don't know what's really going on over there say, well, what's the big deal? Why won't the Palestinians allow or buy into the fact that the Jews should be Israel should be a Jewish state? What's the big deal with that? Well, of course, the big deal with that is that's the basis for the discrimination.
Well, I mean, you know, I certainly, as an American, would not pledge allegiance to a flag that had a crucifix on it. I'm Jewish,
that's right.
You know. You can say America's a Christian state in terms of demographically, that's the majority religion. But, you know, to say that it's institutionally reserves rights to Christian Americans that Jewish Americans or Hindu Americans don't have. No, that's not acceptable.
And that's the way I think we need to talk about it. We need to say,
yeah,
look, do you want a Christian state here in which Christians have some 50 laws which grant them benefits and rights not available to anyone else? Would you like that?
Yeah.
And they say, no. Well, this is what we're talking about.
Would you like to talk about America as a white country, which is... Right. You know, what a good many Trump voters and people like Bannon are talking about, this sort of linking race to this form of hyper-nationalism. That's also what's going on in Israel.
Yeah.
So it's very scary and very ugly.
Yeah. People constantly ask me if I have any hope for a positive solution for the Palestinian cause, and I must admit that I don't have much hope as long as the United States continues to prop up and fund the Zionist project. The task for us activists is clear. We must challenge and change the unwavering support for the Israeli government by our Congress and our president and much of the U.S. population, which do not get accurate news and analysis from our mainstream media, and so remain largely ignorant concerning the realities of the occupation. I don't have to tell you how much work it will take to change that climate and how long that will take, but it is the essential step to Palestinian liberation. I mean, that's my take, and I wonder whether you see any hope here.
I do see hope in two places. One, I think you're right that the mission of, you know, American support, you know, and we should not, I think, in America be in the business of telling other people what to do. I don't think it worked out well for the indigenous people in Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or anywhere else that we've intervened. Standing Rock. I don't think it's, you know, we have a great track record in, you know, telling other people what to do and having that work out well for them. But I do think that the work of advocating for a human rights standard applied to both sides, applied to any conflict, that work is going forward. I see pretty, you know, I think America by and large changes its mind in churches and on campuses. And that's where I see the Palestine solidarity work taking hold in spite of the attempt to criminalize it and silence it and shut it down. You know, for some obvious reasons, one, Israeli behavior is so glaringly awful to American eyes that are used to thinking about equality and civil rights. And also because, you know, the Holocaust generation is dying off. And I think among younger Jews, I'm told more than 50% marry non-Jews. So Jewish identity is being redefined, as all identities get redefined over time as events change. But most of all, I want to say I do think it's critical that the American stance change to create some breathing room over there. But I think one should also not underestimate Palestinian sumud, which is a term they use to mean steadfastness. And so many people are not leaving. They're staying put. And there's an anecdote in that Mondo Weiss piece that I did. We do homestays in Bethlehem in Christian families. And so my host at my homestay this January, was a carpenter. And he has an ID issued by the Palestinian Authority. He has an Israeli biometric ID. He has a security clearance, sort of like our trusted traveler ID from the Israeli government. He has a businessman's card issued by the Israeli government because he runs a carpentry business. And he has a church documented, generated ID document because he works for the church as a carpenter. And so he's allowed to go from Bethlehem to Jerusalem every day to work, as long as he works only on church properties, churches, church-run schools, church-run hospitals. So one day he comes to the checkpoint with his portfolio of identity documents and his tools, and the 18-year-old with the big gun says to him, "No, refused. Go away." And he says, "But why? I have all the right documents, and I was here yesterday, and they let me." "No, refused. Go away." So he picks up his tools, because everyone who hires a Palestinian who has to come through a checkpoint from the West Bank knows that some days they're just going to be refused, and that's part of the deal. So he picks up his tools, prepares to leave, and the soldier says, "No, come back. Try again." So he puts his hand on the fingerprint reader again. "No, refused." So this happens five times. The soldier refuses him, calls him back, refuses him, calls him back. So after the fifth time, this soldier, this 18-year-old with a big gun, looks this man who's probably 60 in the eye and says, "How do you feel when I do this to you? Do you feel humiliated?" And so this man said to me, you know, I took a deep breath and I looked right back in his eyes and I said to him, "No, I'm fine with your behavior. I'm getting to walk around. You're the one stuck behind the desk." That is Palestinian samut.
Yeah, that, you know, steadfastness.
That steadfastness. They also, you have to know, the best educated Arab population, the highest school completion rates, the highest college completion rates, the highest PhD completion rates. For PhDs, they have to go out of the country, but the highest per capita PhD population in the Arab world. So they are getting on with their lives, and I think
that's part of the resistance. They see that as part of the resistance.
I think that's part of the, yes, they say to exist is to resist. Yeah. And so, you know, it is not only our benevolence in changing the American view of this conflict, but it's also Palestinians who I think are fully capable of understanding that, although it will be very sad for many of them, that they have to reframe their struggle from a national liberation struggle to a civil rights struggle in a multicultural nation. But I think they're totally up to the task.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time, unfortunately. Thank you for what you're doing to educate and involve a whole new generation of students in this struggle. And thank you for your writing. But most of all, thank you for your activism, because you have such a strong sense of justice, and that we need to communicate and that we need to rally around. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to a conversation with professor and author Eve Spangler of Boston College. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.